Now we're going to go on to the next lesson, which is the mortification of sin positively described. Friday night, it was Good Friday, as it is customarily called, and we had a hymn sing out in our backyard, and I got into discussion with David, who is part of this group, and we were talking about the stress that had been on him due to his work and growing a new business. And he talked about how sometimes you could be put into trial after elongated trial, and your heart rises against God for dealing with you like that. And he marveled that those two different principles could even be in a Christian: affection for him and sometime hostility raising up in the heart against him. And that's exactly what we're describing here. With my mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. The law of sin is that principle that remains in us until we die. To quote William Gurnall, the Puritan, in The Christian in Complete Armor, the flesh and the armor go off the stage together. The battle is lifelong. Our goal is to decrease the indwelling sin's power and vigor so that it doesn't fight as before it did. Now, in the previous chapter, we learned what mortification is not. Mortification is not finally eradication of any sin. Sin will be with us for as long as we are in these bodies. Mortification is not acquitting either or forsaking of sin in terms of its outward actions. It's an internal dealing with sin that we have to aim at. Mortification also is not acquiring a sedate or quiet nature. And as we discussed before, some people have a temperament that enables them to, from the outside, look a lot more sedate and quiet. But we discussed that a person who, before he was born again, may have had a trigger temper. He would speak unadvisedly with his lips to everybody. He had a real passion problem with anger. He's born again now, and he begins to bring it into control through mortification. And though on the outside he doesn't appear as maybe somebody who is of the sedate or quiet nature, he may have actually achieved more in the mortification of the inward sin principle than somebody who doesn't have these outbursts of anger. We also discussed it. Mortification of sin isn't just diverting one sin for another, and we discussed it. Young people have more problems with maybe sensuality and burning inside, and that's why they are commanded to be married if they do not have the gift of celibacy in 1 Corinthians 7. Maybe old men don't have that. Hormones raging, of course, as a young teenager would have, or a young man, but maybe their sin is covetousness. But just to divert from sensuality to covetousness as a sin that reigns over you may mean that you haven't mortified either of them. And we made a caution that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not fighting with both sins at the same time. It's not the two sins fighting against you, one stronger and one weaker, but in this case, you're exchanging the mastery of one sin over another. John Owen argued that it was true because they never really mortified either of the sins. They simply changed the objects of their sinful affections. They diverted their sinful lusts. They didn't mortify them. And then finally, we said that mortification is not the same thing as reacting earnestly to sin when it has erupted unexpectedly. or when we are in some grave situation and need God's help. So mortification is not the same thing as having occasional victory over sin. In the book Thoughts on Religious Experience, Archibald Alexander says, "Where two opposite principles exist in the same soul, there must be a perpetual conflict between them until the weaker dies. But as the old man, though crucified, never becomes extinct in this life, this warfare between the flesh and the spirit never ceases until death." As these opposite moral principles operate through the same natural faculties and affections, it is a matter of course that as the one gains strength, the other must be proportionately weakened. And experience teaches that the most effectual way to subdue the power of sin is to nourish and exercise the principle of holiness. Now in chapter 6, we move on to John's own positive comments on the meaning of mortification, or looking at what are the positive elements of mortification. But this is in a general way as we get from chapter 8 to 14. He will get into more particulars. In this chapter, there are three points he desires to make, and that is, mortification involves, 1, the habitual weakening of sin, 2, constant fighting against sin, and 3, having victory and success over sin. A detailed discussion of the argument of chapter 6, to mortify sin consists in 3 things, a habitual weakening of it. Owen begins this section by emphasizing the fact that every lust is a depraved habit or disposition, and it continually inclines the heart to evil. Truly, every man's condition is accurately captured in Genesis 6, verse 5. Every inclination of the thoughts of man's heart is only evil all the time. Therefore, it is important to realize at the outset that sin will set itself against your soul with violence and impetuousness. It will strive to darken the mind. It will aim to extinguish your convictions, to dethrone your reason, interrupt the power and influence of any considerations brought to hamper it, and then break through all into a combustible flame. Its aim is to rise up, conceive new sins, agitate your passions, provoke you to sin, entice you to sin, and disquiet you so that you can never have rest nor peace. And if you give in to it, you will never have any strong assurance of salvation. And Owen emphasize 2 verses here, 1 Peter 2, verse 11, "Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to keep away from fleshly desires that battle against your soul." And James 1, verses 14 and 15, "But each one is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then when desire conceives, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is full grown, it brings forth death." There are, however, 2 exceptions to the idea that every lust equally impels one to commit sins. First, some lusts through one's natural temperament or through certain occasions and opportunities and temptations may be greatly strengthened above other lusts in that man or similar lusts in another man. It may be that Satan has got the man into a particular habit and way of thinking so that now certain sins manifest themselves much more often and with greater power. In any case, all it takes is one lust deeply rooted in our behavior to bring about darkness of the soul. We may still recognize in our minds what is right, but our emotions and affections being so captivated are unable to respond as they should. Second thing is that not all sins tempt us equally, or one sin may be stronger in us that we have to war against than another, in terms of our inward awareness of them and their outward manifestations in us. Paul makes a distinction, for example, between sexual uncleanness and other sins. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18, "Flee sexual immorality. Every sin a person commits is outside of the body, but the immoral person sins against his own body, and the phrase that John Owen uses is, some sins are more of a combustible nature. They seem to blow up and a fire rages that seems to be out of control. And that's more true of sexual immorality than other temptations. To quote Archibald Alexander again, young Christians are often greatly deceived by the appearance of the death of sin when it only sleeps or deceitfully hides itself, waiting for a more favorable opportunity to exert itself anew. When such a one experiences in some favored moment the love of God shed abroad in his heart, his sin appears to be dead, and those lusts which warred against the soul to be extinguished. But when these lively feelings have passed away, and carnal objects begin again to entice, the latent principle of iniquity shows itself. And often that Christian who had fondly hoped that the enemy was slain and the victory won, and in consequence ceased to watch and pray, is suddenly assailed and overcome by the deceitfulness of sin. Christians are more injured in this warfare by the insidious and secret influence of their enemies lulling them into the sleep of carnal security than by all their open and violent assaults. No duty is more necessary in maintaining this conflict than watchfulness. And John Owen says in this chapter, the motions of that sin, sexual promiscuity and temptation, are more discernible than others. Like somebody can be tempted with the love of the world, it could have such a draw upon him, but it isn't a combustible, and so he can more deceitfully hide it. 1 John 2, verses 15 and 16. The love of the world may have captivated the soul of a man more than immorality, but it is harder in some ways for both him and others to detect that he is wrestling with the love of the world. So it follows that the world oftentimes sees a man who struggles against immorality as less mortified than the man who is worldly, and yet one who is a friend of the world may actually have a master over him than the one that is struggling to put the sexual temptations to death. This, of course, is not necessarily the case, but just the motions of immorality are more apparent to us than worldliness, especially when large numbers of people do not even understand what worldliness is. And the thing about worldliness is, a lot of times people are more prone to it, as we already discussed, because the crowd around you of professing Christians say that this is their Christian liberty, and if it's all right with them, then it's not so bad for you. But as a means to the end, remember we talked about means and ends of living the Christian life, is given into what is often called Christian liberty, the best means to the end of buffeting the body, bringing it into subjection, and running a race. John Owen has shown us both the captivating power of sin as well as two ways in which it appears that every lust does not always act with the same intensity to bring about sin. Now that we have an understanding of these things, he brings us to his first main point, and that is, the first thing in mortification is a weakening of this habit of sin, that it shall not impel and tumultuate. John Owen uses the word tumultuate a lot, which means a state of agitation of the mind or emotions. It doesn't create a tumult as formerly it did. That it shall not entice and draw aside, that it shall not disquiet and perplex, the killing of its life, vigor, promptness, and readiness to be stirring. This is called crucifying the flesh with the lust of it. Galatians 5:24, that has taken away its blood and spirits, that it doesn't give it strength and power. The wasting of the body of death day by day. And he uses the example of a man was crucified. At first there's such a crying out because he's such agony, and everybody around hears his pain. And sin cries out when you're attempting to mortify it. It wants to be satisfied, but it's The strength, vigor, and life of it is taken away like a man on a cross after he's been there for some time. The moanings and the crying out become more faint and faint, and he doesn't stir as before he did. He cites two passages to illustrate this. Galatians 5:24, now those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. And 2 Corinthians 4:16, therefore we do not despair, but even if our physical body is wearing away, our inner person is being renewed day by day. John Owen here compares mortification of sin to a man nailed to a cross, as I said, and in Romans 6:6, it says, we know that our old man was crucified with him so that the body of sin would no longer dominate or have dominion in us, so that we would no longer be enslaved to sin. He makes several observations of this verse. What is the inner goal of the crucifixion of the sinful nature? It is so that we might no longer be slaves to sin, that we might not be compelled to obey its every little wish. And this deliverance from sin applies not only to carnal and sensual sins, such as the lust of the flesh and eyes and the pride of life, but also deliverance from the opposition that exists between us and God by virtue of our depraved nature, that is, in our minds and wills. Sin, whether it be causing us to do certain acts of evil or hindering us from doing that which is good, is weakened by crucifying the very body from which it springs. Anything less than this is simply shooting at the fruit and missing the root. Therefore, the mortification of sin first involves the weakening of sin by crucifying its lust, striking at the very root of that sin. And mortification also involves a constant fighting and contending against sin. So the second thing is a constant fighting and contending against the sin that so easily besets us, which has three aspects to this fighting and contention if they are to defeat sin. First, they must realize that they have an enemy. Secondly, they must seek to understand the ways and the wiles and devices of this enemy. And lastly, the height of the contest is to load the enemy down with all sorts of destructive things to his plans and what he aims at. Well, let's describe this. First, let me quote Archibald Alexander. The Christian is a soldier and must expect to encounter enemies and to engage in many a severe conflict. The young convert may well be likened to a raw recruit or somebody that's just gotten out of boot camp. He feels joyous and strong, full of hope and full of courage. When the veteran or aged or experienced Christian warns him of coming dangers and formidable enemies and endeavors to impress on his mind a sense of his weakness and helplessness without divine aid, the young convert does not understand what he says. He's never experienced it. He apprehends no dangers or enemies which he is not ready to face and is ready to think that the aged disciple who has the experience and whom he's having a conversation with has deficient courage and skill, or have met with obstacles which are removed out of the way of the young convert. Some Christians, being unacquainted with the holiness of God, are thoroughly unacquainted with their own sinfulness and the enemy within. They don't know his deceits, his wiles, his trickery. The first step to mortification of sin is to clearly recognize and admit that we have a ruthless enemy and that we are to treat sin as such. Sin is a deadly foe who takes no prisoners. Next, we must seek to understand the enemy, his wiles, the way he works, his deceitfulness. As in any battle, the soldier in charge would do well to know his opponent. He would do well to know his strategies, methods, advances, tactics, as well as the occasions of his success. In this way, he can anticipate and overcome the enemy. Now, to really understand this, this is why I said it is helpful to read John Owen's treatise on indwelling sin before the mortification of sin. But either way, I think it's helpful to be familiar with both of these treatises of Owen. One, to understand the enemy and his wiles and deceits and how he works, and the other, to know how to put that enemy to death. One of the choice and most imminent parts of practical spiritual wisdom consists in finding out the subtleties, policies, and depths of any indwelling sin, to consider and know wherein its greatest strength lies, what advantages it uses to make up occasions, opportunities, temptations, what are its pleas, pretenses, and reasonings, what are its stratagems, its colors, excuses. By excuses, he means sin will always have an excuse. It's a little one, or God is a forgiving God, or that's possibly my concern with the book Gentle and Lowly by Dane Ortlund, and that is, it makes the grace of God so prominent that it's helpful for somebody that needs that kind of medicine. But most of the professing Christians that apply it have no desire really to probe the festering wound to the core. They want the grace of God as a band-aid so they will feel better, but they are not really vigorous about the mortification of sin, and that's why those type of books draw people in. Owen wants us to get to the root of the matter. He does deal with forgiveness, the last treatise of his Collected Works, Volume 6, and it has its place. But to probe the festering wound to the core, we have to study out this enemy and what he is doing that causes us to keep erupting or giving into temptation. And we have to know it, and we have to deal with it. And sometimes that's very painful. It's easy to slap a Band-Aid on and say, kiss the boo-boo and make it better. But to really purge this festering wound so it doesn't grow out into a cancer. Archibald Alexander says, of a Christian who is not mortifying sin and he begins to live the Christian life, gradually the glow of his fervent affection subsides. Worldly pursuits, even the most lawful and necessary, steal away his heart, and various perplexing entanglements beset the inexperienced traveler. He begins to see that there were many things faulty in his early course, his early setting out in the Christian life. He blames his own weakness or enthusiasm, and in avoiding one extreme, he easily falls into the opposite, to which human nature has such a strong bias. He enters into more company with the world and, of course, imbibes insensibly some portion of its spirit. This has a deadening effect on his pious feelings, and his devotions become less fervent and less punctual, and far more interrupted with vain, wandering thoughts than before. He is apt to fall into a hasty or formal attendance on the daily duties of the prayer closet, and a little manner will sometimes lead him to neglect these precious seasons of grace. A strange forgetfulness of the presence of God and of his accountableness to God for every thought, word, and action seizes upon him. Close self-examination becomes painful and, when attempted, is unsuccessful. New evils begin to appear, springing up in the heart. Before he is aware, the imagination is filled with sensual imagery, which, giving him carnal pleasure, the train of his thoughts is with difficulty changed. A lack of prompt resolution is often the occasion of much guilt and much unhappiness. Pride is sure to lift its head when God is out of view. And it is astonishing how this and kindred evils will get possession and grow so as to be visible to others, while the young Christian himself is not aware of the disease going on within him. He becomes angry, impatient, fretful, full of envy, undue indulgence of his carnal appetites. Love of riches tempts him, fondness for dress and show, the love of ease, aversion to spiritual duties, with numerous and similar and nameless evils, now begin to breed in his heart. And they come forth to annoy and retard the Christian in his course. His pride makes him unwilling to open his ear to friendly and fraternal reproof. Such words fall heavily on him and wound his morbid sensibility, so that a conflict takes place between a sense of spiritual duty and his unmortified pride. If a brother rebukes him, and instead of improving the counsel to the amendment of the evil that that brother points out, pride cannot think or brook the thought of being exposed and humbled, and he tries to find something in the manner of the rebuke which can be censored, like this person pointing out this error in me is doing this from a wrong motive, something to get him out from underneath the heat. And brethren, I can tell you that we do this with our wives a lot when they lovingly try to correct us. I'm not saying when wives continually have this fault of everything that we do wrong, they want to point it out and want to dig in. That's not a helpful environment either. But if it's kind reproof in that which is very obvious, sometimes if we're not humble, we're unwilling to submit to it. The next thing John Owen says is you need to load the enemy down. We ought to daily load sin down with all things which are grievous, killing, and destructive to it. We should labor to give sin new wounds each and every day, and this is the height of contending against sin and mortifying it. Now, John Owen will take up this principle in much more details in chapters 8 through 14, as I said before. And the last part of the mortification of sin is continued success against it. You don't just start this and have a few victories and then you rest at ease, but you have to have continual success against sin all the days of your life. Many apostates start out so well. I fellowshiped with them. I'm now in June, it'll be 39 years of just being in Reformed Baptist churches, and the stories I could tell of people I used to fellowship with who were back in the world and want nothing to do with these things. And even Pastor Martin cautions me that it's not how well you begin, it's that you continue to the end, and that's very wise advice. John Owen argues that another evidence of true mortification is frequent success against sin and its motions. Not simply a momentary victory over sin, but rather the bringing of any sinful impulse to the moral law of God, to see it for what it really is, heinous, and the love of Christ to escape condemnation, condemning the sin thoroughly and bringing destruction on the very root or the lust or desire. Owen says that when a man has brought sin to such a place of death in both the root and the fruit, and he can, with a calm attitude, seek out sin and defeat it, he will experience peace all the days of his life, and in him is sin truly mortified. So genuine success over sin is the true sign of biblical mortification. The enemies of the Christian have been commonly divided into three classes: the world, the flesh, and the devil. But though these may be conceived of and spoken of separately, they resist a Christian soldier by their combined powers. The devil is the agent, the world furnishes a bait or the object of temptation, and the flesh, or our own corrupt nature, is the subject on which the temptation operates. Sometimes, indeed, Satan injects his fiery darts enkindled in hell to frighten the timid soul and drive it to despair, but in this he often overshoots his mark and drives the poor trembling soul nearer to his captain, whose broad shield affords ample protection. That last paragraph is also in Thoughts on Religious Experience in a chapter called Imperfect Sanctification, the Christian Warfare, which that book and all of its chapters are online at gracegems.org. If you look under books and by author, Thoughts on Religious Experience in each and individual chapter has a link to it, and I really recommend that book. It instructed me so much as a young Christian. So let's summarize chapter 6 of the mortification of sin. In chapter 5, Owen mentions several points in order to clarify what mortification is not, but here in chapter 6 he has explained what true mortification is and what it involves. First, it involves a habitual weakening of sin at its very root. This is done by crucifying sin and its lust. Second, true mortification consists in constantly fighting and contending against sin. In this battle, we must realize that we do indeed have a deadly enemy, the stratagems of whom we must take pains to learn and to be able to identify, and that we must bring all our resources to bear on him. And thirdly, true mortification, based as it is upon the prior work of God and given us his Spirit and a new nature, will involve enduring success over sin. We won't just start out well. We will continue to do this to the end. And one of the greatest counsels to remember is we must always watch and pray. We must always be on our guard in the mortification of sin. I'm trying to decide if I'm going to do chapter 7, which more deals with you cannot mortify sin unless you are regenerate, unless you are a Christian, and also the false ways of mortification that a person who is in the Catholic Church tries to do, but without the Spirit all is in vain. I may go directly to chapter 8 so that we can get into the details and continue enlargement of what the mortification of sin is.